What's up, Wildside besties and baddies? I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up
and enjoy the ride. Welcome back.
Welcome back. Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday. The most important thing that I have to share to you is I met with a new kiddo, a new client.
Oh, yeah.
And I was going over confidentiality and I was like, you know, we can't be friends on social media, blah, blah, blah. I'm not allowed to do that. And I always try to make it fun. And I'm like, I mean, I'm a pretty cool person. I'm pretty fun, but I don't expect you to want to be friends with this old woman on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And she was like, Miss Bailey, you can't be more than like 25.
So cute.
And I was like, stop it right now. And she's like, no, I'm serious. And I was like, honey, you're so sweet. And she was like, how old are you? I was like, in my mid-30s. And she was like, Miss Bailey, you look like you're in your mid-20s. And I can't tell you how validating that was for me.
I know. It's so sweet. It's so sweet. I'm turning 40 this year. And I tell kids that all the time where I'm like, Miss Chelsea's going to be 40 this year. And they just, I mean, they're just shocked. Like they're like, is the next step, you know, like a funeral arrangement for you? Because I think in their mind.
Yeah, you're over the hill, man.
40 is so old. And I remember thinking that when I was in high school, like, oh my goodness, 40 was old.
How are people 40 years and old? I just want to apologize to every human in this world on behalf of my 16-year-old self who was like, oh my God, if you're over 30, like you might as well just curl up in a hole and die.
I know. So time doesn't really, I don't know. Time's different. Time hits differently for younger kids, but I do get that as well where they're just like, oh, Miss Chelsea, you don't look that old. Have you seen this whole like hairstyle theory where they'll put like the Golden Girls hairstyle, you know, like on J-Lo? And they were like, that's what it is. It was the fact that in, you know, like Grammy's generation, that everybody wore their hair. Like Grammy has always worn her hair. And that's why she looked like she was older, you know, not old, but she looked older. Mm-hmm. Forever. And it's the hairstyle theory.
It's got to be the hairstyle. I'll forever wear my hair long and curly. So hopefully I won't look old.
I know.
I'm having a hard time with that. So
yeah.
And so today has nothing to do with what we're talking about at all. So
being old.
Yeah.
Being old has no part of this case.
I mean, at one point, one of the players in this case calls somebody an old man, but that's about the sliver of the Venn diagram that we've got. No, so this case, actually, Zachary sent it to me.
Oh, my.
And for those of y'all who don't know, which most of y'all don't, but my husband is just not a true crime fan. He always does a heavy sigh and eye roll anytime that I cuddle up on the couch and we'll watch anything true crime.
Mm-hmm.
But he is super supportive in our true crime podcast. And so he'll send me, you know, articles and TikToks that he finds. And this was off of a TikTok that he found and I had never heard of it. So here we are.
Oh, man, my gears are turning because I might have a feeling that Zach sent me the same TikTok, but I don't know. But when you said that.
But it's good that you don't usually follow up on looking that stuff up.
I really don't. So I might know a little bit about this. Is this case going to take place in Colorado?
Don't ask questions.
Okay.
Just eat the food that's on your plate and don't ask questions.
Okay.
Okay. You ready?
Are you ready for it?
Are you ready for it?
I'm ready.
All right. So in the early morning hours of Sunday, February 28th, 2021, so yet another recent case, officers from the Mesa County Sheriff's Office arrived to the Blue Heron Boat Ramp on the Colorado River in Grand Junction, Colorado.
In Grand Junction.
Womp.
Womp. Womp. Okay. I know a tiny tiny, tiny, tiny bit about this case. So I'm so excited for you to do a deep dive. Because like I said, I'm pretty sure Zach sent this to me. And I kept telling him, I was just like, yeah, I haven't really had a chance to look at this. I keep seeing it pop up on my TikTok, but I'm like, oh, this is going to require me to actually sit down and watch this as opposed to like that 5 second scroll. And I just didn't have the bandwidth for that. So in true Chelsea form, I haven't gotten around to that. Surprise, surprise.
Lucky for us. So like I said, the officers from the Mesa County Sheriff's Office arrived to the Blue Heron boat ramp on the Colorado River in Grand Junction. They were called by a woman named Terry Cohey to report that her son's car was half submerged in the river. When officers arrived on scene, they would identify a pretty strange situation that was going on. By the boat ramp, officers were met by members of the Cohey family to include Mama Terry, who made the call, her son Brian Jr., I'm just going to refer to him as Brian, he was 19, and Brian's dad, Brian Sr., who I'm going to refer to as Papa Brian.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So those are the three people at this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Officers met with Terry, Mama Terry, and she had explained that somehow her son had managed to get his car stuck on the ramp by the river, and it was subsequently pulled into the river by the current.
Do you remember that house we lived in Mississippi that had that ridiculous ditch as part of the driveway?
Yeah.
And if you made one false move, your tire would go off and into that ditch. And then you'd have to literally get like a whole tow truck to pull us out because we'd be hanging off and Mom would get so mad because it happened more than once.
I don't remember.
It happened to me at least once. And Mom was just like, Jelly, are you kidding me right now?
Mm-hmm.
So I've been in half in, half out situations in my vehicle.
Yeah. I mean, and that was kind of the case with the officers and Mama Terry and Papa Brian. They were just like, you know, like our son, he's 19. Teenagers do stupid things. It's kind of not really a big deal, right? And so they started talking to Brian and he explained that he had been out joyriding and had come to the river to park his car just to hang out and clear his head, which again, as a teenager, not that super weird.
Sure.
He reported to the officers that he noticed it had gotten stuck. So he tried to get his car out, which just made the situation worse. And so eventually the tail end of his 2007 Ford 500 had gotten caught in the river, which began to pull his car into the stream.
Mm-hmm.
Not super weird, but is literally every one of my nightmares that I have as an adult is driving into water. So there's that. Over the course of the next few hours, Brian, he called his parents who arrived on scene, who contacted the sheriff's office. And so with the help from the sheriff's office, they were able to find a towing company who was willing to send an employee to the scene, wade out into the water, hook the car to the tow truck, and tow it back to shore. And so they went through many different companies who were just like, no,
that's a hard pass.
We're not doing that.
What's above my pay grade?
And so Brian was sitting in the passenger seat of the Cohey's SUV trying to warm up since he had gotten wet getting out of the car when it was in the river. Since there was no accident to report with any other party, officers allowed Brian to return to his house to change clothes and to warm up. Terry, Mama Terry, was able to get the car towed, and both parties, again, just kind of chalked the situation up to teenagers doing stupid things. Mm-hmm. Things happen, no harm, no foul.
Sure.
And so, like deja vu, some officers from the Mesa County Sheriff's Office once again found themselves at the Blue Heron boat ramp the following day.
Mm.
So they're there into like Sunday, the early hours of Sunday morning. And then Monday morning, they're called back to this same location. Weird, right?
Yeah.
And they were called because they were following up on a missing persons report.
Mm.
When they arrived, they were met there by a woman named Monique Lanotti, and she was the owner of a bridal shop there in Grand Junction.
Okay.
So they get this call. They need to go out to this Blue Heron boat ramp area. They're met with Monique, and she starts talking to them. She shared that she had been the one to file the missing persons report for a 69-year-old man named Warren Barnes earlier in that morning. At this point, officers are still a little confused, right? What is going on? What they're trying to understand from all these connections, who this woman is, who's this missing person, so on and so forth. Go ahead.
When you think of the word Monique, do you think of that Petey Pablo song?
Lucretia Monique.
No, I always think of Monique Lhuillier, the wedding gown designer. So I'm really glad that we have such varying thoughts that go through our head.
The Monique who?
Lhuillier.
Who's that?
She's, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, Lhuillier. She's this super famous wedding gown designer.
Oh, no, I think of Petey Pablo.
Yeah, so we complete each other on a spectrum. So Monique elaborates with the officers that earlier that morning, again, this is Monday, she got a call from a company called People Ready saying that Warren's wallet had been found up by the Blue Heron boat ramp by someone who worked for the life jacket program. So she gets a call from this company who got a call from this person saying that this guy's wallet was found. And People Ready, this company, was a job search company that hired individuals for like skilled labor jobs. And Warren had been an employee of People Ready for 4 years, and he had never, ever, ever missed a day of work.
Mm.
So all of this is all happening all at once, right?
Okay.
His wallet is found. He did not go into work Monday morning. And People Ready were just like, this is so out of the ordinary for Warren. And they knew that him and Monique were good friends. And so they contacted Monique.
Okay.
Okay. So when Monique received this phone call, she went up to the Blue Heron boat ramp to try to see if anything had happened to Warren. And that's when she contacted the Mesa County Sheriff's Office to file the report. Are you following so far?
Yes.
Yep. She continued with the officer's questions and shared that the last time she saw Warren was Saturday evening around 5 p.m.
Okay.
She said that he did not show up to the bridal shop on Sunday, and that was, again, highly out of character for him. She reported that when she did see him Saturday evening, she said, I'll see you tomorrow, Warren. And he said, okay, meaning he planned on coming down on Sunday, but he did not show up. So now officers, after they're talking to Monique, they're getting this information that this gentleman, Warren, didn't show up to Monique's business on Sunday, as he said he would. He did not show up to work Monday morning, as he always did. And there was a call from this person that said they found his wallet way out up here by this river.
Mm-hmm.
Officers asked, naturally, if he had a camp set up in this area, and she said no. She said that he would never come up this way this far for any point. Did I say this? But Warren was, he was a homeless man.
I was just about to ask, had a camp set up, as in, is he transient?
He's a
as
local
in,
homeless man.
He...
Yeah. So he knew the community, the community knew him, that kind of thing. And that's why officers were asking, did he ever kind of set up his camp up here? And she was like, no. So with his wallet identified as belonging to Warren Barnes and with Monique filing a missing persons report, officers quickly began their investigation into Warren, trying to identify his last movements and last known whereabouts. Although he did not have a permanent house, he was a staple in the Grand Junction community.
Okay.
Warren befriended just about the entire city of Grand Junction and was affectionately known, this is the sweetest thing, he was affectionately known as the Reading Man.
Oh, why was he known as the Reading Man?
Because he sat and he read. He was an avid reader. And he would also feed the local wildlife. So he's like this sweet old guy who would just sit and read, and he would like share his sandwiches with the birds. Like, he was the sweetest man, I know. And so Monique, the owner of this bridal shop, she would place a chair outside of the breezeway of her shop so Barnes had a place to sit and read.
Stop. Oh my goodness.
And he would sit there when he wasn't working or doing odd jobs for People Ready. He would sit in his reading chair and he would go through like a book a day, sharing his food with the local wildlife. And he would help the store owners move boxes or do odd jobs here and there throughout his day.
Bless it.
And so officers, again, they identified through, I mean, everybody, again, there's a lot that happens at once because there were a couple from a coffee shop that gave him coffee every single morning and had for years.
and he didn't show up to get his coffee.
And
so the police are kind of getting bombarded with these locals who knew him, and they're like, he's not doing his routine, and we're all really concerned about him.
Kind of on a side note, and obviously it doesn't really matter, but did it ever say, like, why he was homeless? Did anybody ever know the circumstances around him being homeless?
I didn't see any of the details behind that.
I'm always curious. I really am always curious why, because I almost feel like it's like, is it a choice? Because at this point, it seems like there are probably lots of people that could have helped him get established somewhere. But I don't know, maybe he kind of enjoyed that lifestyle.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And I don't want to give too much away, but I think that this is a very stereotypical true crime case where sensationalism really overshadows the humanity.
Okay.
Right.
So he's not in his routine. He's not getting his coffee. He's not showing up at the bridal store to read his book. So everybody's spidey senses are going off at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And so officers, while they're, you know, hearing all of these reports from the locals, they learn that Warren is a very gentle spirit, was loved by the community. And so that's why everybody was wondering where he was. And it was very unlikely that Warren would have just up and left. Right. Because, again, he was a big staple in the community. He'd been there for years and years. And this was just kind of his routine. This was his home.
Right.
Unfortunately, for everybody who knew Warren, they would soon discover the really gruesome and really sad details as to what happened to him.
So he didn't just pass away in his sleep one night.
No, because this is a Wild Side podcast.
Part of me is always hoping that we're going to have this, like, surprise. He passed away in his sleep. And
like the old lady off the Titanic.
Yeah. You know, just passed away in her sleep.
And so in a surprising turn of events, later that same day, so this is all still Monday, this whole case happens over literally like a few days.
Uh-huh.
And so later that same day on March 1st, across town, the Mesa County Sheriff's Office received a frantic 911 call from Terry Cohey's residence.
Mama Terry, right?
Mama Terry has a frantic 911 call.
Oh, no.
To the Sheriff's Department.
No. Why is Terry calling?
So I'm going to include a clip so we can listen to that.
I think it's a human head.
It's a what?
I think it's a human head.
Why do you think it's that?
Because it looks like it's all an ear.
Oh, gosh. I mean, okay, here's the deal. I have a son, and I, too, am always a little nervous about going into his room and cleaning out his room because I'm not sure what I'm going to find. But usually it's like a pile of underwear that I'm like...
Or it's trash bags nailed to the wall that he turned into urinals.
Or it's a trash bag nailed to the wall that he turned into his personal urinal. I forgot about that. Oh, can you imagine? Okay. Good for her for calling 911. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh,
so God. As it turns out, when Mama Terry and Papa Brian... recovered Brian's car, remember, the one that had been partially submerged, Papa Brian ended up finding a wallet belonging to a Warren Barnes in the vehicle.
Okay.
And Papa Brian was the owner of that company that had found the wallet.
Oh, he's the owner of the, what was it, People First? Or
no, he was the owner of that life jacket program.
Oh, that life jacket program. Mm-hmm.
And so someone from the life jacket program had called because apparently the People Ready had a card. He had their card in his wallet.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just putting myself in Papa Brian's shoes. Like, this is a whole weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this dude's wallet in my son's car, and I'm going to hope that maybe my son just picked it up, right? Or something, you know, he picked it up and forgot to tell me about it, so I'm going to call and make sure that this guy has his wallet.
Right.
And that's where this whole phone call missing persons report thing started.
So it pretty much was Papa Brian who kind of got the ball rolling as far as the missing person report.
Is that correct? From my understanding, right?
Oh, man.
And then whenever he found out that Warren had not arrived to work, obviously Mama Terry and Papa Brian were just like,
Oh, yeah, right.
So he tells Terry about this, Mama Terry. And so putting the pieces together, Terry begins searching Brian's room. And this is where she found a plastic bag with a severed head and two hands. She didn't realize that there were hands in it at first because she obviously didn't want to keep digging through this garbage bag.
Right.
But she had carried it to the sink, opened it up, saw a human ear. And so that's when they contacted the police. And so Mama Terry and Papa Brian concocted a plan to try to get Brian to the house because he wasn't home. And they didn't want to spook him. They didn't want to raise suspicions. And so they came up with a story, you know, nothing crazy, to get him to the house.
No.
And that's when she called police and said that he's here.
Well, so you know how I've told you that I am convinced that one of these days I'm going to be walking, because I like to walk, you know, like different roads and back, you know, back areas. I just like to walk, not in like a park type of thing, but I'm always convinced that I'm going to find a body. And, but can you imagine like finding, not only finding a severed head, but finding a severed head in your child's closet?
I can't.
Like that is checking so many boxes that should never be checked or never be in the same category to be checked.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm also going to include a clip where the officers arrive on scene and confront Brian.
What's going on, man?
How much? Cooperate. I am going to cooperate.
Okay. So parents have some concerns of some stuff they may have found in your room?
Yeah, I believe so.
And what would it be?
A human head and hands.
The way that he said a human head and hands, I don't know if you can unhear that.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of matter of fact.
Well, and it was interesting because it seems like there was a split second of, what do I do? Do I lie? And then it was just like, nope, we're just gonna show it. We're just gonna do this thing. Everybody's here, might as well. And he's just like, a human head and hands.
Mm-hmm.
What did you eat last night? A plate of spaghetti. Like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And so Brian was obviously immediately arrested on the charge of murder and was taken to the police station to start the interrogation. And I'm going to link this video because they did a really great job. It's Explore With Us. It's the full documentary is on YouTube. And so I'm going to link that in the show notes. So if you guys want to watch the whole thing, you can.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So early on into the process, the investigator asks Brian, so they're in the room, and he says, you know, Brian, how did you get here? And Brian says, I murdered someone.
Okay.
And he continues saying, I'm already going to jail for this. It's murder. And he laughs, adding like 15 years or something, 15, 20 years. And so they start this process. He shares that he drives a 2007 Ford 500. He keeps a large bat and a kitchen knife in his car for self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
He goes on to say that on the night of February 27th, which would have been a Saturday, he decides to go for a drive because he's in a, quote, dark state. He shares with the officers that he's been diagnosed with MDD, which is major depressive disorder. He's been diagnosed with high-functioning Asperger's, and he's been diagnosed with ADHD.
Okay.
He shares he was diagnosed by Brett Phillips from Lotus Counseling, and that's kind of them getting some background before he gets into the details of the crime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
And this isn't funny. It's just interesting. When I go over, like when I get a new client, you always have to go over like informed consent, right? And so you go through the paperwork and these are my limits of confidentiality, but here are the times I have to break it, whether you like it or not. And I, you know, I work with teenagers. And so I usually just tell them like, unless you kill somebody else, then your records should not be subpoenaed. They should be tucked away in our software program.
Yeah.
Nobody should have access to it. Just don't kill anybody.
Right.
And I just wrote this as a side note because I think every therapist's kind of biggest fear is being subpoenaed into a high profile case like this.
Absolutely. Do you remember the time that we found your diary from when you were like 19 or 18 or 17?
I think I still have it.
And it was like, it was almost like Lydia from Beetlejuice, where it's like, I'm alone.
Scratch, scratch, scratch.
I'm utterly alone in the darkness of my weeping soul. And Lucas was like, what the heck is this, Bailey? And you're like, shut up, Lucas. I was depressed, I think. I was in my emo phase.
Yeah. And listen, I was in a dark state too there, Brian Jr., but I didn't go and, you know, keep heads in my closet.
He put it in a diary. Find a diary and a fancy pen.
Find a better hobby. Journal your emotions.
Oh, journal your emotions.
So in this interview, he starts drawing maps. He's like super forthcoming. He's super cooperative. And he starts drawing maps of where he, like what his route was, where the crime was committed. And throughout the process, he's asking questions about like what to expect regarding the legal process and prison and where he went to grade school, blah, blah, blah.
I mean, this sounds like he's been thinking about this. I mean, this doesn't sound like it just kind of happened. This sounds like he's kind of been prepared.
We're going to get to that.
Oh, man.
Oh, there's going to be a whole section of this case about that.
Dun, dun, dun.
And so he identifies that he lived primarily with his mother, but visited his father daily. So there were mixed reports. Some of them said they were like together. But from the other research I did, it said that they co-parented, but they were living in separate houses, like they were separated.
Okay. All right.
And so about 12 minutes, it only took 12 minutes into this interrogation where Brian begins to share what transpired on the evening of Saturday, February 27th. Mm-hmm. And he was saying when he was driving around, he came to an overpass where he saw a large thing wrapped in canvas. And he says in the interview, quote, okay, I'm like, that's a homeless person. So he proceeds to get out of the vehicle, grabbed his self-defense knife, and put on 3 layers of latex gloves. Not one, not two, 3 layers. He shared with the investigator that he put on 3 to avoid the possibility of leaving any fingerprints. Because he heard somewhere that you could still leave fingerprints with only 1 layer of gloves. He said, I took the knife, I pulled back the canvas, and I just stabbed his neck. And he is speaking about Warren Barnes, the reading man, this beloved man in Grand Junction, who is minding his own business and sleeping. Brian goes on to describe in detail in this interrogation video what transpired, and it's pretty horrific. He says that the victim, again, who is Warren Barnes, was, quote, panicking. And quote, he was saying, what are you doing? What are you doing? Why? And I just kept stabbing his neck. At this point, Brian asks if he can do a demonstration of how he was stabbing this man's neck. So he acts out how he straddled Warren, noting that Warren couldn't fight back. And Brian adds in his thespian performance in the middle of the interrogation room, quote, it was actually surprisingly easy. I was barely breaking the sweat. I thought, oh, this guy, he's going to be tough. But no, it was actually surprisingly easy. And so he's kind of talking about it like it's a D&D game.
Yeah.
Brian goes on to describe the murder in further detail, noting that he was growling and was in an animalistic frenzy, noting that he was so excited, so rushed up on adrenaline energy.
Okay.
He again said that Warren asked why he was doing it, and Brian responded that he's been wanting to do this for a long time. Brian said, when I finished stabbing him, he took out his last breath like a grunt, noting that the whole ordeal only lasted about a minute to a minute and a half. He noted that by the time he was finished stabbing Warren in the neck, his head had basically been halfway severed, and added that he didn't feel anything, that he felt numb. But he kept stating stinky dirty. So Brian was saying as he's being interrogated and he's reliving this episode or this horrific murder that he committed, that he kept saying stinky dirty, stinky dirty, stinky dirty. I have so many questions as a therapist right now about this.
Mm-hmm. I know. I have so many questions for you as a therapist. I'm like, okay, pause. Diagnose this whole thing. Break every ethical bounds you have and diagnose this entire thing, Bailey. But you're not going to, so I'll digress and allow you to move on.
Yeah, so we're going to table this for right now. So afterwards, Brian shared that he stripped Warren's clothes off of him. And then he proceeded to cut open his stomach.
Okay.
And he says, quote, his guts, they're really pink. Sorry, that was morbid. And then I cut off his head and I gave him a Glasgow smile.
I gave him a what?
A Glasgow smile.
What is that?
Where you rip from the corner of the mouth like the Joker. He said that he destroyed Warren's eyes by stabbing them. He then cuts off Warren's hands, put them in a Ziploc bag, and continued to dismember him.
What the? Blech. Why? What? Who? What? Where? When? Why? How?
Brian said that he left Warren's body there, and then he took his head and put it in a box that was a leftover dinner box from dinner he had a few nights prior, put the hands in the back of his car, and then drove home. This is when Brian shares that he hid Warren's head and hands in his room and then began to clean up the evidence. He cleaned the knife. He threw away the garbage with the blood on it, the garbage bag with the blood on it. Then he put his blood-stained clothes in the washing machine, mind you, on high speed, and washed it twice. So he was very aware and methodical with all of the aftermath of this.
Right.
He said he then tried to go to sleep, but was worried that maybe he possibly left a fingerprint because there was a hole in his gloves, and he decided to cover up the crime even more. So he changes into a new outfit, drove back to the murder scene, picked up what was left of Warren's body, put him in the trunk, and that's when he drove to the Blue Heron boat ramp. He puts his car in reverse so that it's easier to pull out the body, and then dumped Warren's body in the water. And at this point in the interrogation, Brian says, quote, God knows where he is now.
So his car slipping into the river was accidental.
Yes.
He only intended to dump the body and then get in his car and go back home or go wherever. But the car...
He got too close because he was trying not to touch him with his hands. He was trying to use his feet to kick him out of the car because he didn't want to leave fingerprints. He was hyper-focused on leaving fingerprints. And he got... That's why he got so close to the water.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that's how it got sucked under. He wasn't just sitting there, you know, mulling over, you know, the deep, dark corners of life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So in the interrogation, Brian confesses fully to the crime. Simple, open and shut case. Right, Chelsea?
It should be. But again, like you said, this is wild side. So.
Yeah. So the catch, because there's always a catch in these stories.
There's always a catch.
When Brian ended up obtaining an attorney, he decided to plead not guilty by...
insanity.
By insanity. In Colorado, in order to be found not legally sane at the time of a crime, a person must be found incapable of distinguishing between right from wrong when the crime is committed, right? Because of a mental defect or disease. That's a good definition.
That is a good definition.
What's the face for?
I just don't know how I feel about the insanity thing in general. I just feel like, I don't know, more often than not, it's just like, oh, it's insanity. Oh, yeah, I'm insane. Oh, look at me. Mm-hmm. I have no emotions.
Yeah. And so from my understanding, insanity should involve like any deliberate premeditation and the wherewithal to dismember and dispose of the body. That's just me. I'm not an attorney. I'm not a judge, but that's basic knowledge for my side.
Like, I heard of a case where a dude literally thought that another dude was like the angel of death, and it was like on a Greyhound bus, and the dude jumps up, attacks the guy, cuts his head off, and then is trying to eat him, mm-hmm. all because he swears that this guy is the angel of death. To me, that is insanity.
Sure.
That is, that
that is insanity. Not, I put 3 layers of gloves on so I wouldn't have any fingerprints, and I've been wanting to do this for a long time. It's,
right.
I mean, part of my bucket list, if you would say. It's pretty high up there, right under snow skiing in the Alps.
Yeah.
I just don't feel like that's insane. I don't think that's insanity. I think you're a jerk.
You're a bum.
You're a jerk. Yep, I agree. And according to an article by Sam Klomhaus and Ryan Biller, during his trial, and that started on January 17th, 2023, mm-hmm. so like a little under two years after the murder happened, Brian's attorneys argued that he was diagnosed with mental health disorders, including major depressive disorder, ADHD, and autism, which, listen, that's a whole different... Anyway.
I know. I was going to say...
There's lots of people who have those that don't do this kind of stuff, right?
I was going to say, Bailey has a whole collection of soapboxes over stuff like that.
Yes. And so, again, his attorneys argued that because the combination of him being diagnosed with these things combined with environmental stressors, whatever that would be, caused him to become insane when he saw Barnes and to kill him.
Whatever.
And I think it's safe to say that the prosecution was like,
Ner. Best cap. This kid's just an L. He not a W.
Yeah. They argue that Brian had admitted to planning to kill someone, specifically a homeless person, for months and attempted to get rid of his body, like you said, showing that he understood the consequences to his actions.
Well, yeah. And he admitted, he was like, well, I committed murder and that's going to be at least however many years in jail. Didn't he talk about that during the interrogation?
Mm-hmm. Oh. According to an article by Kristen McBrayer, Brian claims that he was not guilty because he was insane at the time that the crime was committed. But Google Chrome search records unearthed from his phone may sway the jury to believe that Brian knew exactly what he was doing. Do you want to know what Google Chrome had stored?
Oh, I would love to know what's in that lockbox of Google Chrome.
So an investigator with the district attorney's office, this gentleman by the name of Rob Hale, he was called to the stand to discuss Cohey's search history. So this guy who works for the district attorney to find whatever kind of dirt they can on Brian.
Mm-hmm.
They found that just a few weeks prior to Warren's murder, Brian searched for really interesting questions.
Mm-hmm.
One question was, are homeless people safe to be with? From that search, phone data showed that Brian visited an article titled, Why Do Homeless People Congregate Together?
Okay.
It also recorded that Brian visited an article about a separate homeless man that had been killed.
Mm.
And at 12:20 on February 28th, just several hours after committing the murder, Brian searched the web for... I'm sorry, I don't need to laugh.
How to wipe data from an Android phone.
How to wipe down what?
How to wipe data from an Android phone.
I mean, it's like, hey Siri, how can I get away with the brutal murder of the homeless person, Warren Barnes? Oh my gosh, my phone just picked it up. It's going to be on my search now.
Oh gosh.
So because of this, because of what Rob Hale shared with the court, the prosecution argued that the data that they found obviously pointed to the fact that Brian wanted to remove from his phone
his nefarious searching. Like, he wanted to get rid of all the stuff that linked him to, how can I kill a homeless person and get away with it?
Yeah, so the prosecution said that likely what Brian was searching to try to remove were pictures that he had taken of Barnes after he had murdered him.
Oh. Like, I have so many thoughts on this, but number one is always get a better hobby, but number two, I'm like, Brian, why would you go after the Tom Cruise of homeless people? You know what I mean? Like, why would you go after the local celebrity of homeless people? Like, everybody knows this dude.
I mean, I think the normal human response should be like, or anybody, right? He shouldn't go after anybody.
Well,
but
of
I think,
course.
But I think that speaks to the fact that he separates himself in a category from people who are less than.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
true.
Even if he was the Tom Cruise of, you know, that population, he'd still be like, well, you know, your teeth are really asymmetrical from your face.
Right, yeah. No, that makes sense.
Like, there would still be a...
Again, not insanity, just maybe narcissistic or dumb or I don't know, so whatever word, but not insane. Sorry, my friend.
Sorry about you. And so two psychologists with the state of Colorado who examined Brian Cohey for his insanity plea concluded that he was not insane for the purpose of the plea at the time of the murder, right? He was not insane. Another psychologist who performed a separate examination on behalf of the defense said that Brian was experiencing a psychotic episode that was triggered by seeing Barnes and soon after rendering him insane. So you've got two psychologists who say, nah, he wasn't insane. He knew what he was doing. And then one that was hired by the defense said, oh, yeah, absolutely, possibly, for sure, he was insane. The defense also brought in a family doctor and a therapist of Brian's to shed some light on some of his troubled past, right? So they're trying to establish a pattern for this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And according to the same article by Kristen McBrayer, Dr. Craig Gustafson began seeing Brian as a family doctor when Brian was 15.
Okay.
Gustafson had diagnosed and treated Brian for depression in 2018. And then in 2020, when Brian was reported having really bad headaches, Dr. Gustafson ordered a CT scan to check for any tumors or clots, but there was nothing.
Okay.
The results were normal. Dr. Gustafson also testified that other than that time in 2018, Brian did not report being suicidal whatsoever. In fact, just days before the killing, Brian saw Dr. Gustafson for an infected abscess under his arm, and Dr. Gustafson said with the court, said shared to the court, that Brian was, quote, definitely not psychotic at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So this doctor's like, he's fine. He even had a CT scan and everything was fine. There's nothing abnormal going on with this guy. He was depressed in 2018, but not since I've seen him.
Right, right.
B. Phillips took on the counseling role towards Brian. And so Phillips was called, probably subpoenaed to this trial. Phillips had said that they first started working together in 2017. And they had a total of about 24 sessions. And Brian had made remarks such as referring to trans individuals as it, and would get into conversations about, like, Darwinism.
Okay.
And B. Phillips said that Brian once asked, why is it such a big deal to hurt or steal from others? It's what we're supposed to do.
Well, and I'm like, in conversations of Darwinism, as far as, like, the theory of eugenics, like, we need to rid the world of the lesser species so that only the fittest would reproduce.
Like, maybe survival of the fittest, I'm sure. That's what I gather when I hear anybody talking about Darwinism in that context.
Yeah. I mean, eugenics has kind of been, whatever. I'm not going to go off on a history rant, but whatever. I'll digress.
And so this therapist said that they also testified that on one occurrence, Brian had shared in their sessions that he intentionally bullied a girl in order to trigger her PTSD. So this therapist is like, Brian Cohey Jr. knew right from wrong at the time. When I met with him, he knew right from wrong. He knew that he knew right from wrong, right? Like, there was no question whether this guy knew whether this was right or this was wrong.
Yeah, this kid's just kind of a jackhole.
Yeah. And so Mama Terry had initially hoped that this therapist could help her son process the death of his uncle. That's kind of what pushed her into help, like, trying to get him into therapy.
Okay.
But Brian had shared that he got tired of pretending and felt totally ambivalent about his uncle's death.
So I wonder if he was kind of initially using his uncle as the scapegoat for his bad behavior. Like, oh, the reason why I'm being all crazy is because I'm just really mourning this uncle. And then finally was just like, yeah, I'm kind of tired of this facade.
Yeah. And it was also kind of revealed throughout this process that Mama Terry had also taken Brian to the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation for an assessment in 2019. So 2 years prior to the murder, she reported that Brian was unable to understand how his choices affected the future and lives of those around him. There was also another report somewhere else, and I forgot where I read this or where I heard this, but this wasn't the first time that there was kind of an issue of Brian having weird shit in his room. Obviously not body parts.
Right.
But like zip ties and knives and stuff like that. And his parents were kind of like, no, absolutely not. We can't do this. And they threatened to call the police on him if he continued to have these things in their living environment.
Well, and it sounds like they were being very proactive as far mm-hmm. as getting him assessed and getting him with doctors and getting him the, you know, quote unquote, help that is needed. So, I mean, kudos to them for it's, uh-huh. it sounds like they were taking a very active and a very proactive role in
yes.
trying to get their son help.
Yeah, and we all know, those of us who are parents, there's no book on parenting, right? And this is a brand new dynamic that you never think you're going to have to deal with as a parent, right?
No.
So there's not a lot of resources out there for parents who have, you know, kids who are exhibiting behavior that are like dark triad-ish, right?
That's right.
Like kind of psychopathic in a way.
Right.
And also on the 911 call, Mama Terry was saying, like, we thought that he was learning how to channel his kind of like interest or obsession in the morbid and dark into something productive of being like maybe a crime scene investigator, which that's the best thing you could do as a parent is like, okay, you're into this weird dark shit.
Yeah.
You know, you tell them not to do that. They're going to do it anyways. They're going to be more obsessed with it,
yeah.
you know, just behind your back. So, hey, maybe we can channel this into a healthy way. Right.
Right, yeah.
And if we look at most of the psychopaths that walk amongst us, a lot of the very successful businessmen and women likely have some sort of psychopathy.
Yeah.
They've just learned how to be more socially productive with it than
for sure
destructive, right?
For sure.
And so this therapist shared, and this whole trial is just very damning. I mean, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's a joke, but it's very one-sided as far as painting a clear, very clear picture that Brian was of sound mind. This therapist also testified that Brian had, when he was asked about future goals in life, he had responded by saying that he idolized famous people who were famous for destructive acts. Adolf Hitler, the Columbine shooters, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, serial killer Ted Bundy, and former premier of USSR Joseph Stalin.
Okay.
So this individual recommended him out for an immediate further evaluation. And I couldn't follow up on if that was completed or not. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought in other people just to kind of testify about Brian, friends, family members. And I think the general consensus is that Brian felt that he didn't have any friends. If they did, they were out of pity. And then at one point, Mama Terry takes the stand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really sad because she's trying to, you know, kind of take up for her son because that's just what mamas do.
Yeah.
But primarily what she does is she recalls the moment that she discovered Warren Barnes's head and hands in her son's closet. And it was so disturbing that even jurors were crying.
Mm.
And upon walking out of the courtroom, Mama Terry shared her sympathies to the victim's family. And she said, I would just like to express our family's deep and sincere sympathies to the community and family of Mr. Barnes.
Golly, bless her heart. And I wanted to say, I had a thought when you were talking about the process of his past history of saying that he idolized criminal historical figures. You know, he's showing all these telltale signs, right, of something is amiss or something is not quite right. But you also have to remember, like, he hasn't committed any crimes up until this point. So
right.
You can say a whole bunch of stuff. You can say that you think this stuff is cool. I'm interested in it. I think Adolf Hitler might be my hero. You can say all of these things, but you can't lock a person away. You can't. You know, like you can't institutionalize a person just for thinking that Adolf Hitler is the goat.
Right.
And I think that's where it's really frustrating for people on the outside where it's like, well, this kid should have been locked away. He was obviously, you know, showing psychopathic or sociopathic behavior, but it's all talk up until this point. You legally can't do anything, right?
Well, and the other thing, and please don't hear what I'm not saying, okay? But when you're dealing with teenagers who are on the spectrum, they can have various interests in things. And can they become very interested in morbid things like the body or human anatomy? Yes. And they become kind of obsessive because that's just how their brain works.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that they're being sociopathic or psychopathic, but I'm saying if you don't know the difference between those two, somebody who's on the spectrum who gets really infatuated with morbid things mm-hmm. for a pretty kind of normal reason, right. You know, from a developmentally normal standpoint, someone might be like, that's weird. But for that specific case, for that kid, it's not super weird, right?
Right.
And you know, I think at the end of the day, and that's why, you know, even as a therapist, every time I hear somebody say, like, I can't handle this, like, I don't want to be here, does that necessarily mean that they're going to go out and commit suicide that day? Most of the time, no.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that 1% chance, and that's why we have mandated reporting. Even if they say certain trigger words, we have to report things and blah, blah, blah. And so it's really easy if you don't have kind of a constant view on this individual, a lot can slip through the cracks.
For sure.
Kind of to wrap this whole thing up. So even though that Brian Cohey Jr. pled not guilty because of reasons of insanity, the court did not show him mercy and they did not buy it.
Mm-hmm.
After 2 days of deliberation, a jury found Brian Cohey Jr. guilty of first-degree murder. He had also been charged with tampering with a deceased human body and tampering with evidence, and the jury found him guilty on both of those counts as well.
Mm-hmm.
The verdict was read in a full courtroom after Brian Cohey displayed no visible reaction upon hearing the verdict, which elicited an emotional response from a handful of attendees. So that in and of itself really triggered a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Richard Gurley went on to label Brian's crimes as one of the worst cases he'd ever worked on and sentenced him to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In an article by Debangshu Nath, Tricia Marr, who is the assistant district attorney, stated, Warren Barnes lost his life in the most violent of ways. His friends, family, and community suffer his loss. This outcome demonstrates the checks and balances that exist within the criminal justice system. Justice prevailed when the jury rendered guilty verdicts, holding the defendant legally accountable for his horrendous crimes.
Mm.
Brian Cohey was convicted for the murder of Warren Barnes, and he had initially told investigators during interrogation that he targeted a homeless person because he thought no one would miss him. But it turns out that people did indeed miss Warren.
Yeah.
The entire city of Grand Junction has been heavily impacted by the loss of the reading man, Warren Barnes. Monique would share that every single day he would eat Subway and give half of his bread to the birds, half of it. There's not many people that I can say would do something like that to have so little and still give half of it to birds.
Yeah.
She shared that Barnes always refused any kind of handout. Money and food were of no interest to him, only friendship. I've never seen him not finish a book in a day. He would sit behind the shop and just read religiously. He was valued. He was loved. He is missed every single day.
Yeah.
Loving a good Western by Louis L'Amour or a mystery by David Baldacci, Warren's avid reading was one of the most recognizable traits. Not long after his murder, Warren's friends sought to honor his memory with a permanent sculpture that would sit in the same place he did, forever occupying his favorite reading spot.
Ooh.
Friends commissioned a tribute to Warren Barnes that was installed on November 20th, 2021 by an artist and ironworker, Tim Naveen. There, between Monique's Bridal Shop and Out West Books, Warren Barnes' story lives on through a new permanent metal art memorial dedicated to whom some called the Reading Man.
Oh.
Is it that? I could just die right now.
No.
Oh.
I think what bothers me the most, and I think about this a lot anytime I watch any sort of documentary on serial killers or just killers in general, because it does seem to be that you either, it's a crime of passion, right? Like you'll kill your spouse or you'll kill a boyfriend or whatever, or they go after homeless, prostitutes, quote unquote, people that
sex workers.
Oh, is it?
We don't sex say workers. Prostitution.
Sorry. So they go after sex workers. They go after the homeless community. And that is always, it just bothers me It just bothers me because, again, I just hate this idea that people are on a value system. You know, like if you don't meet this criteria, then therefore you are not valuable. And I feel like that is, I'm worried that is something that is learned, you know? So again, what are we doing? How are we raising up our children to view other people, right? Are we raising them up to view them or view society as there's a line drawn in the sand? And if you're on this side of the line, then you're less than. And if you're on this side of the line, you're more than. Because that right there, I think is the most disturbing for me, is why did he view that man as something that, number one, wouldn't be missed, and number two, is, you know, just almost like a play toy, you know, like he viewed it as a guinea pig, like something that he could experiment or carry out his nefarious obsession. And that, it's unsettling. It's unsettling on so many degrees. But I think, like I said, the most unsettling is why was his narrative such that he viewed himself as greater than and others as less than?
I don't know, man. I gotta say that having a kid really changes, almost like molecularly, I think it changes people. And maybe that's just my experience. Maybe that's not across the board. But I can tell you as a therapist, before and after I had the baby, it's very different. My outlook is very different. I am a kind of across the board a what you would call a psychodynamic therapist. I'm real big into, let's look at how all steps of development contribute to who you are now, right? Childhood trauma, that kind of thing. And kind of like a humanistic therapist, I think that all people are good. But what I'm trying to say is, I think that we don't give enough thought or credit to some that people, we come out wired a certain way. Does environment play into that? Yes. But I think that people blame too much on environment, like your parents did a bad job raising you, because it's, again, the illusion of control. You know, I guarantee you that there are people listening to the story and say, how did his parents not know? Why didn't they do anything? Well, he had all these signs. Right. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. And I'm going to tell you right now that having children is the genetic lottery, man.
And I think that's a good point. I think it should have been a little bit more of a broader statement on not how was he intimately raised, but maybe, you know, like, how are we raising, we as in like society, like how are we raising our children, and are we raising them to compartmentalize, you know, to categorize people into greater than or less than?
Yeah, I mean, I think that society can contribute to that. But I think, again, sometimes it's just genetics. You know, one of my favorite sayings is, you have an alcoholic man that has two boys, twin sons, right? Son one grew up to be an alcoholic. Son two did not. You ask son one, son, why did you grow up to be an alcoholic? And he said, because I grew up watching my dad. You ask the second boy who did not become an alcoholic, and you say, hey, why did you not become an alcoholic? And he said, because I grew up watching my dad.
Yeah.
So I just want to say kudos to those parents for turning their son over.
Absolutely. I think that was a really brave move. I think brave is the word that I'm going to use, because that's like, you know what you're about to do when you turn your son over.
Yeah. And the shame that, I just can't imagine. I can't imagine the shame that you carry if your child does something like this, even if you quote unquote raise them better. You know what I mean? Sometimes you just,
I'm really glad that you said that illusion of control. Cause I think so often we do try to look at it as in, with this illusion that we do have control, like, oh, if we would have only taught them, to be more compassionate. If we would have only, and I do like that you always bring in that reminder that sometimes it is genetics.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when the baby was, I don't know, she just started walking. And I didn't know what to expect as a parent, but this child has been fearless and stubborn and wild since the moment she was born.
She really has.
And I've been, you know, I watched my anxiety. I didn't raise my voice. I didn't get upset when things when she was little. And she's just a firecracker. And she's been setting boundaries since she was old enough to communicate non-verbally. And sometimes I'll look at her and just be like, how has she become the way that she is? Because I didn't have a hand in this.
Yeah, for sure.
And she's just that way. And it's really changed my perspective of just like, you know, and then being a therapist, man, let me tell you something. You have really great parents who do everything right for their kids and they make really bad decisions.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's scary, but I just love the story. And I love that so many people loved Warren and cared about him and that he's got a forever lasting statue memorial in Grand Junction.
Yeah, I do as well, because I think sometimes, well, I think every time, like, it doesn't matter your status necessarily. That shouldn't be the requirement for if you're impactful in a community or not.
Yeah.
You know, like, he didn't have a status, but he was kind and compassionate. And also, he was obviously a hard worker, you know, like, he would show up to his jobs, like, he did all the right things. But yet, he was not, you know, the stereotypical lived in the house on the hill. So therefore, he was thought as less than and a target of this teenage dirtbag. Bless. Anywho.
So that is, hopefully, we covered a little bit more of the victim than a lot of these other things, because Warren Barnes was the cutest old man and deserves the proper recognition.
Yeah, I agree.
All right.
I agree. I'm glad you covered it. Like I said, I've seen it on TikTok a lot, so I'm glad that I didn't waste my time getting just these little snippets of sensationalism.
As usual, you guys, thanks for hanging out with us through this wild ride.
And we will catch you on the flip side.
Bye, guys.
Later, Gators.
Hey, Wildside Tribe. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast. Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
We would love to hear from you. So if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below.
As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.